So I'm going to try and stick to my notes as much as possible because today I have more questions than answers, and I'm hoping to maybe go over some of the things that I've been struggling with in my own work and have a bit of a conversation around that. So we were asked to introduce ourselves, and that is the part where I always stumble. That's like the tell me about yourself part of a job interview or a first date that feels really uncomfortable. I do want to thank Andrea and Alexis for stressing interdependence, because I'd like to talk a little bit today about my struggles with the notion of autonomy and what that's meant in my work. So I was a poet for a long time, and I was really believed in performance, because performance and poetry for me was a battle cry, or it felt like a battle cry. And I came to feel over some time that there was something about the performance of radicalism that really let people off the hook. It felt like a form of catharsis that exercised actions that audiences weren't doing and that we weren't doing together. And I grew increasingly uncomfortable with the notion of a didactic conversation and the ideas about, you know, authorship and publication and what it meant to be published on a page with your name and just your voice. So I've tended to work recently, trying to work more collaboratively with other artists in participatory art spaces. But my discomfort with authorship is probably going to make me a very poor sociologist. I also teach sociology at an undergraduate university, so perhaps my academic career will be a short one. So right now, I'm really interested in violence, and I'm interested in borders. I'm going into my fourth year of a research project that began really slowly. I was teaching poetry in a women's prison, and this funny thing happened where a clinical staff person in the maximum security unit at NOVA came up to me and said, "Oh, where did you learn to do dialectical behavioral therapy?" And I said, "Oh, ha ha ha. What is that?" And she said, "Oh, I thought you must know what it is. That's what you're doing when you teach poetry, and that's actually the only treatment for women with borderline personality disorder, and everyone in the MAX unit right now has that." I was like, "That's interesting. I've been a youth worker for the last 13 years, and I'm familiar with working with young people with different diagnoses related to trauma, psychosis, mood disorders, eating disorders, and I'd never heard of a personality disorder." And the critical activist in me was like, oh, now we have disordered personalities. And I was kind of rolling my eyes at the medical industrial complex when I heard this. But I started to think about it more and more, and I started to ask the women that I was working with about what this whole borderline personality disorder thing was. And it's really interesting because it's related to trauma, apparently, according to the literature. You are 10 times more likely to be incarcerated, especially as a woman, and it's primarily diagnosed in women, and there are some very gendered reasons for this. So you're 10 times more likely to be incarcerated if you have this set of specific symptoms that are related to your relational behavior with others and your acts of self-harm on yourself. And the interesting thing about it is that it's called borderline personality disorder because for years, they noticed in the 1930s especially, it was misdiagnosed because it looked like other symptoms and disorders that psychiatrists and medical professionals were working very hard to separate into these neat and tidy and pure categories of madness. And it touched on many of them, but it never fulfilled any diagnostic category. And fast forward to I'm doing my PhD in Montreal, and I happened to meet a fellow by the name of Arash Aslani, who was detained as someone who was illegal. He was detained as an illegal immigrant here in Canada, and he was talking about his experiences being incarcerated, and he said, "You know, when you're a citizen of nowhere, my experience in being incarcerated in a Canadian facility, that experience of being a nowhere person, of not being a citizen, was more violent than the physical torture I received in Iran," because he was physically tortured in Iran. And he started talking about these little bureaucratic things that would happen in immigration detention, like having to sit in a chair for 8 hours, you're not allowed to sleep, you're not allowed to have a nap. All of these tiny little mundane practices of detention, he said, did more to erode his sense of self than any physical torture he'd received. And then I returned to Halifax, and I returned to the maximum security unit, and a lot of what I was hearing from the women sounded so similar to what he said about being a citizen of nowhere. And I kept all of this to myself because I didn't want to impose my critical activist notions about detention and immigration and incarceration onto their experiences until one day I was actually at Dee Dee's having coffee with a young woman with borderline personality disorder. And she was reading me some of her poetry, and we were talking about, you know, she'd just come out of inpatient care, and she said, you know, there's nowhere for me to go. I want to harm myself all the time. My relationships are really troubled. I'm a citizen of nowhere. And she said the same thing. She said the exact same thing that Arash Hazlani had said about being detained in an immigration detention facility in Quebec. So this idea of borders and this idea of the affective internal landscape of borders really has me thinking about what state violence and what violence is. And I've come to feel suspicious that I think our social movements don't really have a strong an accurate and clear picture of what that affective violence of everyday life is like, and how much of that affective violence is traumatic and harmful and related to these very pure categories that we, you know, we order ourselves in day-to-day life. Even something so simple as a complaint form when you're in jail. The tidiness with which you have to explain you've been sexually assaulted by another inmate is really very traumatic. And the coldness of that bureaucracy, I think, is very harmful. And so one of the things I'm working with is an idea of trauma-informed social justice and what that would look like. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who was very involved in one of the Occupy movements a few years ago. And she had this interesting experience where one of the folks on their spokes council that was making decisions about what was happening in the Occupy camp began to be very sick. And it was clear that he was suffering some form of psychosis. And there was a lot of rhetoric and a lot of discourse going on about, you know, autonomy and making decisions and the Occupy zone being very autonomous. And she began to be very worried about him. It was very cold out. He wasn't wearing shoes. He stopped eating. And eventually, she had to violate her anarchist activist code of respecting the autonomy of individuals and their freedoms, and she had him committed to an inpatient facility. And she was expelled from the Occupy camp. One of my favorite poets, Martin Espada, one of his books is titled "Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands." And so when I think about this quote, what I think about is, well, what really is the difference between a secure institution like a prison or a psych facility and the circle of a lover's hands that holds you down when you want to self-harm and you don't want to let someone self-harm, right? So if we think about these ideas of crisis, suicide, self-harm, psychosis, there are times when we are caring for people who may not be helpless, but where the notions of autonomy and consent become less useful, and this idea of compassionate care becomes, I think, more useful. And so I find myself often in abolitionist spaces where there's a lot of talk about abolishing secure institutions altogether. And I was a committed prison abolitionist for a very long time until I started meeting a lot of young people that are involved in the Mad Pride movement. And you know, one of the things that they have pointed out to me is that, you know, there was a body count when secure mental health facilities were shut down in Canada and the United States in the 1960s, when the abolitionist movement in psych facilities became successful. I've come to really question that, and not question the idea of abolition, but question how abolitionist practices get absorbed into neoliberalism and the only services that exist get shut down, and we don't have an alternative in place. And that is what I worry about. And so I've come to think about this idea, well, if prisons are harmful and if psych facilities are harmful, and I absolutely believe that they are, and I believe that their bureaucratic cultures further traumatize those who need compassionate care for trauma, can we think about these facilities in a harm reduction framework rather than an abolition framework? If these facilities are harmful to us, but if it's all we have, can we think about it that way? And I don't know if that's is a useful framework, but I'm interested to hear what people think. So Lastly, on the Mad Pride idea, one of the young women that I work with, we do speaking tours to do education about mental illness with folks who work with youth. And she talks about overcoming anxiety and overcoming self-harm through a practice of radical vulnerability. And I think that that's just so beautiful, this idea of radical vulnerability, because I think it's really a response to thinking about ourselves as activists in a very sort of autonomous sense, and moving that forward into a space where we can become more vulnerable and open to those interdependent relationships. And so her notion of radical vulnerability is what I'm trying to incorporate now into my own abolitionist politics when I think about institutions. So in working with youth involved with Mad Pride movements and working with women in prison with borderline personality disorder and young women in the community who also have been categorized in such a way, I often find myself straddling activist spaces and their spaces, and there's very little overlap. And so I just want to briefly, before I end, talk about, we're supposed to talk about some of the barriers and challenges to the futures that we want to see. And I think one of the biggest barriers to a trauma-informed social justice movement is our critiques of medicalization and sometimes our critiques of capitalism. I'm very critical of capitalism, but when we critique the pharmaceutical industry, we're often not talking about our grandmother's nitroglycerin pills that she needs to stay alive and keep her heart going. We're usually talking about psych meds. So if you have someone in the room and in that space who is choosing pharmaceutical intervention to assist them with something they're experiencing emotionally or psychologically, that can be incredibly stigmatizing. And it also insinuates, you know, it insinuates this world in which all of these diagnoses, these pure categories in the diagnostic and statistical manuals, they may be bunk in some ways, and we can critique them all we want, but if you are a citizen of nowhere, sometimes that diagnosis is the only citizenship you have. And taking up that diagnosis and advocating for yourself on that basis is an act of resistance. So when we're really suspicious of someone's diagnosis, or when we say things like, oh, you don't really need those meds, or you're just depressed because of your experiences with trauma, you know, that can really be deflating and really devalue acts of resistance that have been years in the making. I think that sort of stigma needs to go if we want to include people in our movements who are struggling to overcome trauma or to overcome, you know, challenges that might not be visible. And in terms of abolitionist politics, I'm just really interested in having a conversation around how can we envision an activist politics that still accepts that we need the circle of a lover's hands and we need some kind of borders and boundaries with which to hold each other in crisis after trauma. And yes, our institutions are cold and they are full of plexiglass and they are full of staff that are feeling all this cognitive dissonance because they often can't even hug the people that are in those institutions without being called inappropriate. So I think we need to look at rebellion not as having autonomy, but look at rebellion from these institutions in a way that builds sort of more supportive community-based networks and structures for abolition.